From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
This year's flu season is hitting children and young adults particularly hard. The CDC reports there have been twice as many pediatric flu deaths so far this year compared to last year at the same time.
In addition to flu, outbreaks of pertussis, known as whooping cough, are also raising concerns. On today's program, we'll discuss the flu, whooping cough, and other infections with a Mayo Clinic expert.
Also on the program, we'll learn about surgery without a scalpel, gamma knife radiosurgery, and understanding palliative care.
All that, along with a Health Minute from Vivian Williams.
Well, it's still early, but the flu season is already off to a bad start.
Here to talk about the flu and other infections, including whooping cough, is infectious disease specialist and vaccine expert, one of our favorite guests, Dr. Greg Poland. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, good to be back.
So, Dr. Poland, is it shaping up to be a bad one, this flu season?
It already is a bad one.
Really?
It's not going to be a bad one. It's a bad one.
Because we don't not a good match, or
well, several reasons. One is we have not had the season start off as an influenza B season for three decades, so that's an issue for kids and infants.
They're not as immune to B as they are to A.
Right, they have not been exposed to it the way us as older adults have been exposed to it.
Okay, so that's one reason.
The second reason that we have is, as you say, the match. And this is there's a subtlety here. Remember that the vaccine has four different vaccine viral strains in it, okay? So the H1N1 strain, the match is essentially 100%. For one of the B strains, essentially 100%. For H3N2, about a 35% match. For the B. Victoria strain, the one that's causing most of the problem right now, that matches about 60%. Now, what that means is that it's not a perfect match, but there's still some coverage. People have the tendency to think, it's only 30% or 60%. Why should I bother getting it? So that you don't get pneumonia, so that you don't get hospitalized, so you don't die.
We're in the middle of January. What are the statistics we have so far this season?
So the estimate is there have been already about 10 million illnesses in the U.S. About 87,000 people have been hospitalized. And really tragic and sad, Tracy, is that people that were here among us just a few months ago, almost 5,000 of them are now gone, have died because of flu, a disease that we know how to prevent and we know how to treat.
The statistics show that there have been a fair number of pediatric deaths. Is that because it's a B strain?
Exactly, Tom. There have been about 32 pediatric deaths, about two-thirds of those due to this B strain that's circulating.
Now, I read on a couple of cases, a young girl in Iowa went blind from the flu. Hadn't heard that.
Yeah.
She got very sick, almost died, ended up, she's alive, but she's blind.
Yeah, that is a very, very, very rare complication. It does happen, and it relates to an encephalitis, an inflammation of the brain. And in this unfortunate case, it affected the optic nerves and pathways. And so this girl lost her sight.
11-year-old boy in New York recently died, and his mother maintained that he had had the vaccine. I guess we don't know when he had the vaccine.
Yeah, there's some controversy over that she may have been referring to a dose he got last March, which would not be the dose that he should receive this season.
Is March, well, when is it too late to get the vaccine?
It's never too late to get it for that season.
Mm-hmm.
So we give the vaccine all the way up until it expires, which is usually June 1st. One thing different about this season is it started very, very early. It started in the South. There's a pediatric hospital in New Orleans that had between July and October had 1,200 hospitalized cases.
Wow. So even a good match or not a good match, you have always maintained and always told us that if you get vaccinated and if you get the flu, it will be less severe because you have had the vaccine.
Exactly right. Now, we're talking at a population level, right? There are some people who may be so frail or who are immunocompromised, where that may not hold as true. But when we look at a community level, at a population level, getting a vaccine, even if it's not a perfect match, offers some cross protection, some crossover, such that the antibody will affect that virus, even if it's not a perfect match, so that you don't get as ill, as sick.
You have advocated for so long for people to get the vaccine, but isn't it true that only about 50% of adults in this country get the vaccine?
It's so frustrating. There's several interesting things, and this seems to hold true across all vaccines. Women get them at higher rates than men. Older people get them at higher rates than younger people. Healthcare providers are not very good about getting their vaccines, which is a real paradox. Pregnant women are not good at getting influenza vaccine.
And it's extremely important for them, isn't it?
Very important. I mean, we see deaths of otherwise healthy pregnant women and hospitalizations and loss of their baby as a result of flu.
How do you know if you have the flu? And because norovirus is going around in my neck of the woods, that is not the flu. So let's talk about both of those.
Yeah, you know, we use the term the flu, and it refers to everything, every illness in the wintertime. The flu or influenza is a distinct clinical syndrome of high fever, muscle and joint aches, and cough, sore throat. It is not a runny nose. It is not diarrhea. It is not feeling worn down. It is not nausea.
And how about compare that to the norovirus?
The norovirus is just the opposite. It's nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea.
And what about getting tested for the flu? If you feel like you may have the worst cold ever, should you go in and get tested?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you are pregnant, if it is a young child, if it's an older adult, if it's somebody that has any kind of comorbid illness where this could be a complicated case of flu, absolutely get in as soon as possible. We ideally like to see those people within 48 hours of developing symptoms. So you don't wait around in those cases to see, am I going to get better or worse? What about for you and I? Working people, otherwise healthy. If it's a mild case and you're not developing, you know, any particular problems, you know, rest, stay at home, fluids, etc.
Chicken soup.
Chicken soup actually has some data behind it to show that it helps.
All right. So we know that you have those three antivirals available. Tell us about how effective they are, when you use them, and would you ever use an antiviral medication if you hadn't done a test that was positive? In other words, you were guessing that they had the flu.
Yeah. So let me kind of take those in order. All of the viruses circulating in the U.S. at this point are susceptible to all three antivirals. So we're not really seeing any resistance. That's number one. Number two, as you mentioned, we have three different kinds. The newest one, called Baloxavir, is a single dose. And within 24 hours, the viral titers in the body are tremendously reduced, and people get better very rapidly with that. So there's no reason to delay treatment. We want to see those people within 24 to 48 hours. There's an oral medication called Tamiflu, and then there's an inhaled medication called Zanamivir. In terms of testing to see if you know, you have flu and if you should be treated, it depends on the circumstance. So in July, I would test because there weren't a lot of cases. Right now, in the midst of an outbreak, if you have a clinical syndrome that looks like influenza, you just get treated.
So the new one is Xofluza, Baloxavir, and is that oral?
It is. It's oral.
Okay. But you have to take it within 24 to 48 hours of onset of the disease,
correct,
of the flu. And it only reduces your symptoms by a day or two, right?
By about, well, it reduces it 24 hours faster than the other medications.
Okay. And expensive?
And it is expensive. There's a price to pay.
You have one in your pocket?
I don't. Sorry. But that's because I got the flu shot.
Yeah. Okay. Can you get the flu twice in the same season?
Absolutely. Yes. Remember, there are four different strains that predominate in a flu season. We have all four circulating, not at the same levels or rates. So absolutely, you can.
All right, we've gotten an update on the flu, and now it's time to talk about the whooping cough. Why in the world are we seeing cases of whooping cough?
Yeah, well, we see them most winter seasons, number one. Number two, this is a bacteria we're talking about now, not a virus. Number three, we've encountered a really interesting issue. Number one, the bacteria has probably subtly mutated, something we don't generally see in regards to vaccine pressure on that bacteria. Number two, remember that we switched to a different kind of pertussis vaccine, not the whole cell vaccine anymore, but a new acellular pertussis vaccine. That vaccine does not induce high enough antibody titers to last over a long period of time. In fact, by about 4 years, protection probably wanes.
Oh, so your immunity to the bacteria actually wanes, and you're more susceptible.
Right. And then the third thing is low immunization rates. So we're sort of battling all three things simultaneously. In 2014, we had 33,000 recognized cases. Last year, about half that, about 16,000. We don't have any numbers yet for this year.
It's a big deal. I mean, people like crack their ribs from whooping cough.
Well, with my young son's permission, when he was, about 11 or 12 years old, and here I'm an experienced physician with this, I heard him cough when he went to bed, and I'd never heard that cough from him. He didn't have a whoop, but it was a very unusual cough, and I said, he's got pertussis.
How old was he?
He was 10, 11 years old.
Really?
Cultured him the next morning. It was positive. Got him on, and so nobody would have gotten on antibiotic therapy any faster. That kid coughed for, and the older clinicians will call it the 100-day cough illness. He coughed for almost 100 nights.
And he started treatment right away.
Within 18 hours.
Wow. And so is the message that if you're getting a pertussis vaccine that you just need to get it every 4 years?
No.
Okay.
That's. I wish that were an answer in a sense that easy. We need to have a more immunogenic vaccine, but without the reactogenicity of the whole cell. Right now, of course, kids have a recommended schedule, but for us adults, there's a dose recommended in adolescence, and then in adulthood, a one-time dose. The only exception is pregnant women again. They should get a dose of it with every pregnancy.
So it's part of the DPT, the diphtheria, the pertussis tetanus vaccination.
Yes.
You're supposed to get it 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, somewhere 15 to 18 months, and also 4 to 6 years.
Correct.
But then you're suggesting that maybe a booster later on.
And then what they get is just the acellular pertussis, or if they're younger, TDAP. But for us adults, we get acellular pertussis as part of our tetanus shot.
Now, this is a highly contagious disease, too, isn't it?
It's fairly contagious, yes.
And babies, most of the deaths occur among babies, right?
That's exactly right.
But they haven't been vaccinated,
Or they often have not received enough doses yet by the time they get infected. So, you know, for example, we recommend that the parents be immunized to protect that baby because they may have a dose at 2 months, another dose at 4 months. They're not really protected until three or more doses have been received.
So it must be very frustrating for you that parents, some parents, and more parents are not getting their kids vaccinated.
It is immensely frustrating. I cannot tell you the angst of counseling a parent whose child has died, or a grandmother who has died of a disease that could be prevented or had a significant complication. That family, that community, that church is forever changed by the loss of that person. And it's maddening that it has to happen every year, every community. And I think in part it's because people think, well, whooping cough, wasn't that a disease of the past? I haven't seen that. Must not be a very common or dangerous risk. Exactly the opposite is true.
I'm interested to hear that one of the theories is that it has changed, it has mutated.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that. How can we know if that's true or not?
Well, the Australians have actually been looking at and typing these various strains, and they have one of the toxins that this bacteria produces is called pertactin, and they've noticed that some of the strains are pertactin deficient. So a vaccine against that protein, which is no longer present, isn't very helpful.
Where is this campaign of misinformation about vaccines coming from?
It has always been present. I published an article but must be about a decade ago in the New England Journal, called The Age-Old Struggle Against the Anti-Vaccinationists. This started with smallpox vaccine back in the time of George Washington and before. People just have this almost sort of indwelling sense that if they're otherwise healthy, why take a vaccine to prevent a disease they don't yet have?
Yeah.
And so they, and of course, you know, there are low-grade fevers, sore arms, et cetera, and they misinterpret that as something dangerous. Or they, with Andrew Wakefield and the MMR vaccine, misinformation gets propagated, and people who are not, you know, very scientifically sophisticated will grab on to that as a reason to not get their vaccine.
Yeah. You never discount the power of a good conspiracy scare.
Oh, yes.
Also, what that does to humans,
yes,
in our minds.
Yeah.
We are running out of time, so let's move on to HPV vaccine.
Yeah.
What did you want to address on that issue?
Well, I think the issue with HPV vaccine is for people to recognize that once one becomes sexually active, essentially everybody will get infected. Now, fortunately, most of them will resolve that. But in the U.S., about 33,000 new cancers a year from that virus. This vaccine protects against the 7 different cancers that can be caused by this virus and the anogenital warts that occur. The problem is immunization rates are too low. Again, women do better than men. Women are about up to 55% or so of them have been immunized, about 45% for men. Just recently, they have raised the age at which that vaccine can be given to age 45. Used to be limited to people below 26 and below. Now up to age 45.
So I did read recently that adults between the ages of 18 and 26, this is boys and girls, men and women, vaccination rate has increased from 22 to 40%.
Yeah, that's
so that's pretty good, but the goal is 80%.
Well,
so we got a ways to go.
100%. But,
This interview was recorded last week, and we asked Dr. Poland about the new coronavirus, but since then the story has evolved. So he joins us by phone for the latest.
Dr. Poland, what is this coronavirus?
Coronavirus is a class of viruses. There have been 7 different ones now with this new one out of China that have been known to infect humans. I want to make the point that coronaviruses are the common cause of the common cold. What's different is mutations that allowed these to, for example, become SARS, MERS, and now this novel coronavirus.
And we now know that it can be transmitted from human to human.
And that's one of the pieces of news that we didn't know last week for sure. This is transmissible from human to human.
Typical symptoms?
Fever, shortness of breath, headache, sore throat. Those are the primary symptoms.
And we do have someone diagnosed in the United States. Should we be concerned about it?
Yeah, I think that we should be knowledgeable, but not overly concerned. This is not somebody who has transmitted it within the U.S. This is somebody who traveled from the epicenter of the outbreak to the U.S. So we know there's an incubation period involved. Standard precautions that we talk about with influenza are the exact same precautions here. Wash your hands frequently, keep them off your face, stay away from people who are ill. And if you are ill, stay home yourself.
All right, so there's really no treatment for this disease, and if they get it bad enough, it causes pneumonia, and that's what causes the deaths?
Yeah, the deaths have occurred, about 17 deaths so far, not only due to pneumonia, but due to overwhelming viral replication, so you start getting multi-organ failure.
You've said that there's a company working on a vaccine. What do you know more about that?
Yeah, there are actually a number of companies that have been working on a coronavirus over the last handful of years after SARS and MERS, and they're taking multiple approaches. One is a live vaccine, one's a nanoparticle vaccine, one is what's called mRNA technology. So a number of approaches that are being tested in very early stages. We will not, however, have a vaccine that will be used widespread in humans for probably several years.
It's been such a quick developing story. I mean, with your past experience in infectious disease outbreaks, what do you think will be happening in the next few weeks?
Well, one of the key things, Tracy, is that we need to understand what's called the R0, the transmission rate, as well as the case fatality rate. What we can say right now, based on very limited, very dynamic and rapidly changing information, is that this virus seems to be causing critical illness and sometimes death, primarily in older people or people who have underlying medical problems. In that respect, it would be very similar to flu and seems to have a mortality rate about that of flu.
So certainly at this point in time, you're not concerned about a pandemic, a worldwide epidemic of this virus.
I think what's different as opposed to any other time in past human history is that this was picked up very quickly. The virus was sequenced very quickly. And kudos to the Chinese scientists who put it into gene banks so that we could get access to it, begin to develop vaccines and antivirals. And we know what to do. These simple respiratory precautions work. The one ringer in all of this is that the Chinese New Year is about to start, and an estimated hundreds of millions of Chinese travelers will travel around the world. And, you know, in that time since SARS, the amount of train traffic out of China has doubled. The amount of airline traffic has gone up sixfold. So, you know, there's some concern there, but I think our CDC has prepared us well.
So tell us once again what we can do to protect ourselves.
Well, I would say several things. If you're flying on an airplane in that area, same thing I would advise for flu. If you're near somebody sick, wear a mask, turn your air vent on, blowing the air away from you, wipe down your area with hand sanitizer or wipes, wash your hands frequently, keep your hands away from your head, and stay home if you're sick and stay away from sick people.
So a face mask, should we all have face masks?
Probably not, unless you're in a situation where you're around ill people or around a known case. What a face mask does do is it protects you from large respiratory droplets, like when somebody coughs. And it's a reminder not to put your fingers into your nose or your mouth. But in terms of aerosolized virus, like what happens when somebody coughs, it probably won't protect well. You need a special mask called an N95 mask that's been fitted specifically to you.
By the way, do disinfectants kill the coronavirus?
Yeah, we expect that any antiviricidal disinfectant would work.
All right. Thanks so much, Dr. Greg Poland, infectious disease specialist and vaccine expert. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll learn about surgery that doesn't use a scalpel, gamma knife radiosurgery.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams for the Mayo Clinic News Network. Let's talk about high-intensity function training, such as boot camp-type exercise classes. They're super popular. Dr. Edward Laskowski, co-director of Mayo Clinic Sports Medicine, explains how you can benefit from this type of exercise while avoiding injuries. He says we have an epidemic in this country of obesity and sedentary lifestyle, so anything to get people motivated and moving is good. High-intensity functional training programs are usually very motivating. They're social, and they involve very simple things, oftentimes just your body weight, to get your heart rate up and receive benefits. The programs tend to include exercises that involve jumping, ballistic movements, or movements that are complex to perform and come with a higher risk of injury. That's why Dr. Laskowski says when it comes to strength training, technique is key. It's not practice makes perfect. It's perfect practice. He really wants the good perfect movement patterns in your body's tissue to be loaded equally. For example, if you do a squat improperly, the back could be at risk. With burpees, your shoulders and wrists could be at risk. When you do the exercises, your technique should be the best it can be. One way to ensure optimal technique is to monitor fatigue. Dr. Laskowski says when you get tired, your form tends to deteriorate, making you more susceptible to injury. Also, Dr. Laskowski emphasizes the importance of letting your trainer or program instructor know of any pre-existing injuries or medical conditions. They can modify exercises so you still get results without risking injury. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Tracy, have you heard of a procedure called gamma knife radiation?
I have, yes.
Actually, gamma knife radiosurgery? Well, it's a type of radiation therapy, actually, that is used to treat lesions in the brain, including tumors. Now, it's not really surgery. There's no incision. And in fact, that's part of the appeal.
No incision, no hole in the skull, and you go home the very same day. Here to tell us more about gamma knife radiosurgery is Mayo Clinic neurosurgeon Dr. Bruce Pollack. Welcome to the program. It's great to have you here again.
Great. Thank you for having me back.
Thanks, Dr. Pollack. So it's a funny term, radiosurgery. Explain to us what that means.
Okay. It was basically a marriage of two disciplines. So you were combining radiation oncology and neurosurgery. And so when they came up with this concept in the 1950s, they essentially labeled this radiosurgery.
And radiation oncology would mean radiation for cancers,
or yes.
Radiation for tumors.
Yes.
Where does the gamma come in?
The gamma comes specifically with this device in that the radiation sources, which emit gamma rays, which are very, very similar physically to X-rays, but because they were using cobalt-60, it released gamma rays, and so that came up with the idea of the gamma knife.
So you've identified a lesion in the brain, and you've decided that a gamma knife is appropriate to treat it. How do you make that decision, and what's the planning like?
Essentially, there's a number of factors we think about. It comes down to the size of a lesion, its location, and other patient comorbidities, as well as patient preference.
So if a patient is ill, you might do this as opposed to surgery.
Correct. And if the thing that radiation does not do, that surgery, meaning resection, does, is it doesn't relieve mass effector size. So if it's a large lesion where symptoms are being caused by pressure on an adjacent structure, then the next step would be surgical removal. But if it's basically symptomatic related to location, but it's not very large, then often radiosurgery is a good alternative to surgical removal.
How is this different from regular radiation?
Well, typically when we think of radiation therapy, we think of larger field radiation where the dose is broken up over time, whether it's days or weeks. The older definition of radiosurgery was that all the radiation was given in a single session. More recently, it's been broken up that it could be up to 5 sessions, but with the gamma knife, it's almost always given as a single session.
And how long does it take? How long?
The throughput from showing up at the hospital to leaving typically is on the order of 3 or 4 hours. The actual radiation delivery can be as short as 10 or 12 minutes or as long as 2 to 2.5 hours.
And what holds the head steady?
We use a frame. The head fixation is based on a frame that has pins that actually go through your scalp and capture the outer portion of the skull. And so it's a rigid fixation. Once that's in place, then we do imaging, and then we use that imaging to identify the target within this frame. It acts like a map.
So does the gamma knife, in essence, remove the tumor, or what does it do to the tumor?
Basically, it acts like any radiation in that the energy of the radiation causes disruption of the DNA within the tumor with ideally very little damage to the adjacent tissue. And so as the tumor tries to divide and grow, there's enough double-strand DNA damage that the cells can't match up their DNA, and then subsequently your own body comes in and eats up the tumor. And so for tumors that are slow-growing, they're where only 1 or 2% of cells are ever dividing at a time, these things will shrink slowly over the course of many years, whereas more malignant tumors where 30, 40% may be dividing at any time often will show shrinkage within weeks.
Are a fair number of these that you do related to metastasis, meaning a patient has lung cancer, kidney cancer, and the cells have broken off, gotten into the bloodstream, and metastasized to the brain and grow there? Is that a fair?
It's the most common indication, certainly with across the U.S. and the world. We still continue to do a large number of benign lesions here at the Mayo Clinic, as well as vascular malformation and functional disorders, but the workload of almost every radiation greatest surgical center is brain metastases.
Vascular malformation.
Basically, the one we treat primarily is an arteriovenous malformation. It's typically a congenital lesion of abnormal blood vessels within the head that can cause a stroke or a hemorrhage. And so the goal of the radiation is to block off the blood vessels over time, and then blood can't get through the AVM, and then your risk of a subsequent stroke pretty much becomes zero.
So you avoid a catastrophic event.
Yes.
And how do you find those AV malformations?
Historically, the majority of them showed up after a hemorrhage. But more recently, as people get imaged with headaches and dizziness, we find a lot of incidental AVMs. And so the decision of making that we're going to intervene for your unruptured AVM is different. And patients' mindsets are very different. So if you come in after a stroke, you're much more amenable to thinking, I would have my head opened up for that. However, if you go in and say, I have some dizziness, and we say you have this thing that may cause a stroke in the next 30 years, an outpatient-based procedure is often more tenable to the patient.
Yeah.
What are some of the side effects of Gamma Knife surgery?
The immediate side effects are almost zero. There can be some local tenderness at the pin sites. There can be localized swelling, but you don't get hair loss and nausea and vomiting like you do with radiation therapy. We think of our early effects, and early to us usually means over months, where there can be swelling of the adjacent tissue that could cause headaches or potentially a seizure if it's in the right location. And then there's long-term effects that are getting less and less as our treatments get better. We're able to deliver the radiation more accurately. And so the amount of radiation that's going to the adjacent tissues is less today than it was 30 years ago.
So patients have that Gamma Knife procedure, and then how long do they wait to see if it worked? I mean, it's not immediate, is it?
No. It depends on the reason of why we did it. So for benign tumors, we typically would image you at 6 or 12 months later. For a vascular malformation, a year or so later. For a malignancy, we typically do imaging roughly every 3 months for the first year. On that imaging, we look at the tumor itself to see if it's responded. We look for radiation injury. But our biggest thing we look for on the follow-up imaging is more tumors. Sure. If we do a Gamma Knife procedure for a brain metastasis, the chance you'll make another tumor within the brain in a year is roughly 50 or 60%.
And then you zap that one.
We often will zap it again. We have people that are frequent flyers and will come back 6 or 7 or 8 times over.
So the most common indication is for a metastasis, meaning a cancer that's gotten into the bloodstream and spread to the brain.
Yes.
And how big of a lesion can you treat?
If it's surrounded by brain, usually a 3-centimeter rule, which is slightly more than an inch in diameter, is about as big as we can go. But if it's a lesion that's against the bones at the base of the skull, often we can go quite a bit larger than that.
And your success rate, I assume, with AV malformations is very good.
Yep.
Benign tumors, you can pretty much cure those most of the time?
Very much, almost always.
Do you ever do primary cancers of the brain, meaning a cancer that started in the brain, didn't spread there?
Yep, it's very infrequent. There's a few indications in which we do it, but cytoreductive therapy or surgery followed by radiation therapy and chemotherapy is certainly the mainstay of care for that indication.
You said you're getting better at reducing the side effects. What is new in Gamma Knife surgery?
Over time, several things. Our imaging has gotten better. Our platforms for dose planning have gotten better. The devices itself have gotten better. And at this point, we're actually entering our 31st year of clinical practice with the Gamma Knife in Rochester. So we're approaching 10,000 patients. Our understanding of doses that we need to use, predictable side effects, when to image people, all these things have been accumulated over the decades.
Have you been here that whole time?
I have not been here that long. I'm coming up on year 24.
So just the last 5,000 for you?
About the last 5,000.
Wow. That's right.
Gamma Knife radiosurgery, it's an alternative to traditional surgery to treat several different lesions of the brain, benign tumors, malignant tumors, AV malformations. You know, it's safe. It's a one-time treatment, and you go home the same day.
Our thanks to Mayo Clinic neurosurgeon Dr. Bruce Pollack. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
palliative care. You know, we've heard about it before, but it's specialized medical care that focuses on providing patients relief from pain and other symptoms of a serious medical illness. Now, who's a candidate? Who could benefit? What services does a palliative care team provide?
And what's the difference between palliative care and hospice care? Joining us by telephone from the Mayo Clinic in Florida to explain is palliative care specialist Dr. Maisha Robinson. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Dr. Robinson, for joining us. Now, she is not only a palliative care specialist, she's also a neurologist. Actually did her residency in neurology right here at the Mayo Clinic. So, but how do you like it in Jacksonville?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm enjoying my time in Jacksonville. I split my time between neurology and palliative medicine, and I also have a neuro-palliative care clinic here. So I'm thoroughly enjoying the work that I'm doing.
Neuropalliative care, meaning that patients with brain issues, strokes, et cetera, you provide palliative care for them?
That's exactly correct. Not only strokes and brain conditions, but also people that have, for instance, dementia, multiple sclerosis, ALS, almost any neurologic condition can benefit.
And unfortunately, there are a fair number of those.
I think we're still at a point where palliative care and hospice care are confused. So set everyone straight.
Yes, I think a lot of people, when they hear palliative care, they automatically think we're talking about hospice care. What I usually say to people is that palliative care is a focus on trying to improve quality of life for people that have serious or advanced medical conditions. And that's really an umbrella term. Many people with advanced conditions, some chronic conditions, can benefit from palliative care. And it's appropriate, we say, at any age and at any stage. Hospice care is palliative care, but specifically for people who are closer to the end of life, usually when people have a prognosis of 6 months or less. If the disease progresses in its normal fashion, they are eligible for hospice care. So all hospice care is palliative care, but not all palliative care is hospice care.
And part of the difference is if you're in palliative care, you don't have to stop treatment for your underlying condition. But generally, when you go to hospice care, medical treatment stops. Is that correct?
That's essentially correct. Usually when people are in palliative care, it can be concurrent with their, for instance, chemotherapy or the treatments that they're getting for lung disease or heart disease or with dialysis. In general, when people transition to hospice care, they're really focusing on comfort, quality of life, and not necessarily life-prolonging care. Now, specific discussions would be had with the hospice team about what medications and interventions would continue and which ones would not.
So if you are a candidate for palliative care, how do you get hooked up with the team? Do you have to be in the hospital to see a palliative care specialist?
So let me say, almost all providers are providing some degree of palliative care. We call that primary palliative care. Your primary care doctor, your neurologist, your cardiologist, everybody is trying to help people live better with a better quality of life. But then there are specialist palliative care physicians and teams, for instance, that's what I do, and we can be referred to by people's primary care doctors or other specialists, the same way that they can refer you to a cardiologist or a pulmonologist or a neurologist.
What's the most common reason? I mean, why would a family practice physician say, you know, I think we need to get the palliative care team involved? Why would that be?
Many times if people are having difficulty with complex symptoms, or if there are some issues between the patient and family members, or if there's a question about what's the next best step or what are the goals of care, people may say it's good to sit down with a specialist in palliative care to really talk through some of these issues or to make recommendations for treatments or management moving forward.
Is it covered by insurance?
It is. It's actually billed in people's insurance companies the same way other consults are.
It makes sense if it's improving people's lives, trying to help them as they go through a diagnosis. The dialysis example is perfect because that's something that is a long term that you need to survive. But it definitely brings hardships on the patient and the caregivers.
That's actually correct. And many times people and their loved ones, their caregivers, are silently going through many emotions or thoughts or questions about what is the best next step. Do we want to continue the dialysis? And if so, for how long? Or do we think the dialysis is still being as helpful as it was when we first started it? Sometimes just having some of these conversations takes the burden off of the patient or family members, and they are able to speak openly and honestly about what they actually want, what their preferences are.
You've talked about a palliative care team. Who's on your team?
Generally, palliative care teams include a group of people. We call it an interdisciplinary team. So there are physicians, often some advanced practice providers like a nurse practitioner, physician assistant. We have social workers. There's usually some spiritual care providers as well, and a nurse.
Are you particularly adept at helping with pain management?
We are. We spend much of the time during our training focused on symptom management. So pain, but other non-pain symptoms are also things that we often see, such as nausea, constipation, shortness of breath, and we can provide some recommendations to people's primary care physicians or other specialists about how to manage some challenging situations with those symptoms.
How often do you get the family members involved? Is that an important part of what you do?
Absolutely. Our care team is not only our patient, but also their caregivers or family members. And so much of what we do during our discussions in the office or in the hospital are, A, focus on symptom management, talk about goals of care, provide some support to caregivers, asking about how are you coping with everything going on and making sure that we know what the resources are that they need and try to align those with the available resources that we're aware of. And so those are kind of the three big things that we do. And the last one I would say is advanced care planning, which is a gift not only to the patient so that his or her wishes and preferences are known, but also really to the caregivers and families, because they feel like they can honor their loved one's wishes and not feel the guilt of making those decisions unilaterally.
Do you also help patients and their families decide between different treatment options?
We often will be asked to see people to talk about what's the next best step. And many times patients and the family members will come and say, this is what has been offered to us. What do you think about that? And it's more of a discussion about what are your goals? What are your priorities? What are you hoping for? And oftentimes that helps the person and families with what the best decision is with regard to treatments. And so while we don't often lead people to either treatment A or treatment B, we facilitate a conversation about what may be best for them given their situation.
Well, you've done a good job of explaining that quality of life is the main goal of what palliative care is all about. When patients and or their caregivers are thinking this is maybe something that we should look into a little bit more, what would you suggest that they do?
So Mayo Clinic has a website for our palliative care group, and they can look on there and read a little bit. There's also a video that highlights a couple of patients that have had good experiences with the palliative care group, and I think that'll provide a little insight into who we are, what we do, and perhaps how they could benefit.
Palliative care, it's a resource for anyone living with a serious illness. It can improve quality of life, it helps with managing pain, and it helps patients understand their choices for medical treatment. And if you opt for palliative care, you don't have to stop treatment for your underlying disease.
Palliative care, a great resource for anyone with a serious illness. Our thanks to palliative care specialist Dr. Maysha Robinson from the Mayo Clinic in Florida. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Dr. Robinson.
Thank you.
And that's our program for this week.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.